This is Sound Ideas. I'm Willis Kern. The lack of consistent funding is hurting the U.S. transportation system.
Right now, we're ranked about 16th in the world, and we're falling. This is not where the greatest nation in the world should be.
But Michael Malanafy has high hopes for a new transit bill in Congress. The head of the American Public Transportation Association made a stop in Normal. A lack of funding is putting the hurt on Illinois public universities, including ISU. President Larry Dietz is in the studio. He'll take your questions about the latest on the state budget and MAP awards. And guitarist John Primer remembers Muddy Waters, who would have turned 100 this year. Primer was in the Blues Legends band 35 years ago. He talks to GLT's John Norton. All of that and a GLT News update on the way. It's Wednesday, October 14th, 2015. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT. With additional support from the Jack Batal Real Estate Group, more information at jackknowshomes.com. This is GLT.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Willis Kern. At the beginning of this month, several public university presidents signed on to a letter requesting Governor Rauner and Democratic legislative leaders bring an end to the standstill that's left Illinois government without a 2016 budget. The fiscal year is now more than 100 days old, and no agreement is in sight. One of those presidents who signed that letter is Larry Dietz of Illinois State University. Each month, President Dietz joins us during Sound Ideas, and he's here today. Thanks for stopping by.
My pleasure. Good to be with you again.
Do you have a question for ISU President Larry Dietz? Are you concerned about the lack of a state budget and its impact on ISU and higher education? Call 309-438-8910 and speak with President Larry Dietz. Among other things, the letter university presidents sent to the governor and the General Assembly said the budget impasse, quote, casts a shadow of uncertainty over the campuses that is unsustainable. It went on to say the uncertainty of not knowing when or at what level appropriations will be forthcoming is resulting in some students and faculty questioning whether Illinois is the best place to learn or to teach. Now, we are on the brink of serious operational damage. Midterm exams are not far off, and so too are decisions that must be made about staffing, academic offerings, and student services for the spring semester. Specifically at ISU, what spring semester questions are left most outstanding by this situation?
Well, as you know, we're in the fourth month without a budget, and this is really unprecedented terrain that we're in. I think the worst part of all of this is the uncertainty. We've been asked to put together plans for budget cuts all the way back to about this time last year, and we've done that. So we have plans that are scalable. We certainly hope it's any cuts will be on the lower end of the spectrum versus the 31.5% that was in the governor's proposal. But nevertheless, whatever it is, we just simply need to know where we're headed so we can apply the plans that we have in place. I think the most frustrating thing is the uncertainty.
No one I know remembers a budget impasse lasting this long into the fiscal year. Now, the governor is the only player who is really different in this game. So do you blame the governor for this?
You know, I don't really blame anyone. I understand that there are different perspectives on the financial circumstances that face the state of Illinois and different ideas about that. It's our job really to serve students, to teach the students that have come to us in good faith. It's our job to put faculty in the classroom to help do that, to put staff in service positions to allow us to do our jobs. And we simply feel like that we're doing our job. Illinois State was in eight national rankings last year in terms of academic quality, service offerings. All of them were about quality and positive attributes of the university. And so we want to continue those positive attributes of the university, but we simply need the state to do its part now and give us a budget, and we'll say thank you, whatever that amount is, and we'll apply our planning processes and we'll march on down the road. But we need to march on down the road.
I want to get back to the overall budget in just a moment. I'm Willis Kern, and this is Sound Ideas. Do you have a question question about the state budget and its impact on Illinois State, call and speak with ISU President Larry Dietz at 309-438-8910. The Monetary Award Program, or MAP, is the process that allows many low-income students to attend college. Typically, state funding covers the cost of tuition for these students. About 4,000 students are MAP users at ISU. Here's what you said at the beginning of the school year in August, as you promised to credit those classes to the accounts of the MAP students.
We're optimistic that funding will come through for that, and so we think it's the right thing to do to try to cover that investment internally until we can be reimbursed for that.
Do you remain optimistic that MAP funding is on the way?
Well, I'm by nature an optimistic guy, so I think at some point in time the state's going to figure out how to fix the budget scenario and to give us a budget. Hopefully the MAP issue will be resolved sooner versus later, because it impacts our very neediest students the most. And so my concern, I guess, is that we address MAP, but we also not forget that we still don't have a budget. Even if we were to get approval for MAP funding, our stance right now at Illinois State would be for the spring semester is to not block registrations from students who are MAP funds, but to go ahead and enable them to register and enroll, and we'll do the same thing that we were doing essentially in the fall, which is basically allow them to continue, and then when the MAP funding comes through, we will go back and credit those accounts.
And the cost is about $15 million or so for the students to attend Illinois State University to receive MAP funding. That's the cost to ISU and to the state.
And we have about 4,300 students that receive MAP, and the total ticket for the academic year is about $15 million, about $7.5 million per semester.
What are the options if there is no state budget into January, which now seems more and more possible? What happens in January when there's no state budget and no MAP funding to go with it?
Well, we'll continue to carry that that red ink, and we have budgeted wisely and conservatively, and we're going to be able to do that. Some other institutions in the state, however, have decided that they don't have the wherewithal, financial wherewithal, to do that. The community colleges, as a group, I know many of them have decided that they're going to be putting hard holes on students for the spring semester unless the MAP money comes through, that some of those people may not be allowed to come back. Most of the public universities, because our students have different needs and they have made different kinds of decisions. For a public university, those students have moved downstate, upstate, across the state, and are making a commitment that is well beyond a day or a month or a semester. They're making an academic year commitment and disrupting where they live and so forth to be here. So we really, as public universities, feel like we have an ethical obligation to continue to provide service. We hope that the state will value our partnership and make a positive decision on this well before January.
Are you a student who receives MAP grants to attend ISU, or do you know somebody concerned about the budget impasse? President Larry Dietz is here, and he takes your calls right now at 309-438-8910. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Willis Kern. Following the State of the University address last week, you spoke with the media and said you were still hopeful for that the budget cut for ISU would not be the 31.5% that Governor Rauner proposed the last winter. Yet this is one of the scenarios the university has been planning for. What are the elements of this scenario?
Well, we could spend every waking hour of every day doing different budget simulations. We have done those at various times with various levels, and until the state makes up its mind what the cut is really going to be, we think it's we've got good plans in place. They're generic kinds of plans and they're global plans, but we would be able to accommodate whatever comes our way on this. We are very optimistic that it's not going to be at that 31.5% range. But again, the uncertainty to us is the biggest concern, because right now is when students and their parents are making decisions about where they're going to be attending for next fall. So it's not only about the issue for FY16 for the current students that are enrolled, but other students that are attending college fairs across the state, they're making decisions now. So we really need a budget now to signal that we have some stability.
I'm curious about your optimism for the not 31.5%. You already said you're an optimistic guy, but right now it's 100%. You have no budget. So what makes you think that it might not wind up being 31.5%?
Well, we've had a history in Illinois, albeit the percentage, each year has gone down some from the state, and that this year, for example, or last year, I should say, only a little less than 18% of our total budget came from the state. I don't think that the history is such that they won't provide anything to the public institutions in the state of Illinois, either through MAP grant or the overall budget. I do know though, and I'm not, it's not a panacea, and I'm not trying to be Pollyannish about this, but I do know that every day that goes by that we don't have a budget, there's about 90% of the overall budgets are that's already committed to organizations that either have court orders that is forcing the state to do something for them. We're one of few organizations that don't have that kind of protection. So
could the university presidents bind together and sue the governor and the legislature?
That's not something that we entertain very seriously. It's not a great way to make friends in the legislature.
Could be a good way to get money, though.
Or in the governor's office. So we're hopeful that that won't continue or that won't happen. I do know that some of the institutions are looking into this as a possibility, though, that we don't think it's a high probability.
The budget is, we talked about the 31.5% scenario, and it may or may not get to that. That remains to be seen. But at some universities, they're already starting to lay off people. And I know that Illinois State University has seen some holds on some positions where I think most of the vacancies are occurring at slots on campus. But what is the possibility of human capital if we creep up close to the 31.5% at ISU?
Well, 31.5% would be devastating. The situation that we have right now is that we have really gone about this, we think, in the most humane way possible, and that is to simply not fill positions that we've had attrition, either through retirements or people taking other positions in other places. And we have 76 positions right now that have remained unfilled. We also continue to provide high-level scrutiny on all positions, but 76 remain vacant. I think that number will continue to grow, but we have been able at this point to avoid layoffs and furloughs and trying to keep the quality that we have.
ISU President Larry Dietz is the guest here during Sound Ideas on GLT. You can join this conversation with your phone call at 309-438-8910. I'm Willis Kern. Just days after the governor received this letter from university presidents, you hosted him at a football tailgate party and a home football game. Some public social media comments criticized the governor for taking time to do this in light of the budget situation. And even there were some people who remarked that ISU was at blame for having him here on campus. Was this the right thing to do in light of the seriousness of having no budget?
Well, we're a public university, and I think it's incumbent upon us to host elected officials regardless of what party they happen to represent and regardless of the position that they hold with within the state government. And so we were delighted to have the governor here. We had a number of other elected officials here that day. As a matter of fact, we have Representative Brady's daughter. It was family weekend. Representative Brady's daughter goes here. Representative Sandak's daughter goes here. Congressman Rodney Davis's daughter goes here. And so all three of those elected officials were here as well. And so it was really about the spirit of family weekend that those three individuals attended. And any other elected official that wants to come and see the quality that exists at the university, we're always delighted to have them.
You spoke privately with the governor. Was there anything in that conversation that either A, gives you hope, or B, causes you peril at all?
A football game is not really the time to do a lot.
You were dissecting the punts and the passes.
That's right. Not a great time to do a lot of business. But I think that the alums came up, and he was interacting quite a bit with alums and other public individuals. And so I think that he understood that we needed a budget, and other people made those points pretty dramatically. Matter of fact, next week, on October the 20th, is going to be a student lobby day in Springfield, and so a lot of the students are going to be going down for that, as well as a number of the public universities' presidents that will be going down to that. And then on the 22nd, the presidents of the public universities and of the community colleges are slated to meet with the governor in different settings, and we hope to deliver that message to really both sides of the aisle and to legislative leaders as well as the governor.
Also last week during the State of the University address, you announced the appointment of Greg Ault as the new Vice President for Finance and Planning. He's been filling that role as an interim for more than a year now. His appointment has an end date of December 2017. Now, how typical is this in the hiring practice at ISU that you do that with an employee, typically a cabinet-level employee?
Well, it really didn't. It really didn't set a precedent. We've had individuals at high levels, including a former president and a former vice president, who were appointed under these kind of terms. And I also consulted with all of our shared governance participants, and they thought it was a good idea. We were in very uncertain budget times, as that we've been talking about. Greg has a very strong background on the budget side of the House, and I think that giving him a two-year appointment is appropriate at this time in our situation with the state, and he's doing a great job, and I know we'll continue to do so.
ISU conducted national searches to fill the positions of provost and vice president for university advancement, which oversees fundraising at ISU. There's a search in progress now for your successor as vice president for student affairs, although an interim, Brett Patterson, has been in place for a while. How do you decide whether to have a national search or whether to appoint an internal successor, such as you did with finance and planning?
Yeah, well, typically, these are all national searches. As a matter of fact, the finance and planning position will be a national search in 17. We just simply need some consistency to get over a very bumpy financial time at the university, but that will be a national search in 17 as well.
If you have a very strong internal candidate, why spend the money on a national search? And how much does a national search cost? Is it thousands of dollars?
Well, it really kind of depends on the position. And it also depends on the shared governance process. I rely on that, and that really, in these kind of high-level positions, generally does call for national searches. We have a strong group of candidates internally. They've been doing great jobs, and so, as a matter of fact, as you mentioned, two of those in national searches have ended up being the individuals that our shared governance group said they should be in the positions on a permanent basis that they're in. So we have really good people internally. But having said that, unless you do a national search, you don't know who all else is out there that might also be doing a great job. So each of these get called on their own merits, but overall, I'd say we do national searches. There is a cost to that to bring candidates in, but we think that cost is, we want to make sure we've got the best person at a particular time. And the only way to do that, in my estimation, is to open the process up, and that's usually what we do.
Civic engagement has become a thing at ISU. You've established a Center for Civic Engagement, and its interim director is Jan Peterson, who examined best practices at other universities. She'll be conducting a thorough review as to what should be included in this center. But what is your vision for this Civic Engagement Center?
Well, civic engagement is one of the five values of the university, and as such, we've been doing civic engagement kinds of education for a long period of time. I felt it was an appropriate time to move all the activity that we've been doing under a larger umbrella of a center, not to control necessarily, but to coordinate activities across the campus with faculty and staff. Jan Patterson, that you mentioned, she has been involved with this for quite a long period of time. She's the former dean of students and has a particular expertise in this area of civic engagement. So it's going to take a while to get the center together. We want to make sure we're following best practices, and we have a number of subject matter experts that are going to come in and help Jan in putting together the infrastructure for this.
ISU President Larry Dietz is a regular guest during the show. Thanks for stopping by.
Always a pleasure to be with you.
I'm Willis Kern, and this is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from the Jack Baytall Real Estate Group at Keller Williams, committed to helping you find the right match. Buying or selling your home can be easy. More information at jackknowshomes.com. This is GLT.
You're tuned to Sound Ideas. I'm Willis Kern. Ahead, what's new on the Bloomington Normal restaurant scene? Larry Carius fills us in. That's coming up during Sound Ideas. The head of a major transportation organization in the United States is stressing the importance of investing in infrastructure. Michael Malanafy is the president and CEO of the American Public Transportation Association. He spoke with WGLT's Michael Hill during a visit to Normal.
What are the challenges small and large transit systems have in common?
It's all about funding, first and foremost. We have to have adequate funding, operating and capital to run our public transportation systems. But it's also about the workforce. We have to have the people that make the trains and the buses run. And certainly here in Bloomington Normal, it's having technicians and drivers.
All transit systems depend on state and federal subsidies. What could difficulties at both levels of government mean when it comes to funding for transit systems?
Transit is funded through a combination of funding sources. There's, of course, the fares that the passengers pay in every transit system. Often the state participates, and certainly they have for many years here in Illinois and they've been excellent partners at that. There's a local community that puts their money in. Then there's the federal share. And in most cases, the federal money is used primarily for capital. And that's how you buy your buses, your shelters, and build your facilities.
Efforts to resolve the Federal Highway Trust Fund seem to be going nowhere. Where is your confidence level that a deal will be reached soon?
I'm highly confident we're going to have a deal soon. The Senate's already passed their surface transportation bill, the DRIVE Act, and it's up to the House now. We expect them to drop a bill soon. The reason I'm confident is this. We have elections coming up next year. This is one of the few bills that is bipartisan. It hits all 435 House congressional districts, every senatorial district. They want to be able to show that they can move a bill through Congress that's important. This bill is going to be it.
Besides funding transit, the Federal Highway Trust Fund provides money for infrastructure, which is used by buses. Can you characterize the state of our nation's transportation infrastructure?
Our infrastructure has been underinvested in for a number of years now. In the transit space alone, there's an $88 billion backlog in infrastructure investment. And what does that mean? That means we have passenger trains that derail. We have bridges that are collapsing. We have other investments we have in our roadways and the other parts of our transportation network. It all has to work as a system. If we don't invest in it, it will continue to deteriorate and will become less globally competitive.
How does that compare to infrastructure in other nations?
Right now, we're ranked about 16th in the world, and we're falling. This is not where the greatest nation in the world should be.
You're here to celebrate Connect Transit's recognition as the outstanding small system in North America. What lies ahead for Connect Transit?
Well, first of all, congratulations to all the great leadership at Connect Transit, to their board, to Andrew Johnson, and the whole team over there. They are the best small system in North America, and they have worked hard to earn it. And all the people at Bloomington Normal should be tremendously proud of their transportation system. What this means is you have a community that's more globally competitive. You can attract good employers because you have good transportation choices, and that makes this city better off, as they compete to bring more business to your community.
Assuming that Connect Transit sees an increase in ridership, could they become the best medium-sized system in North America?
Just keep riding and we'll make it happen here.
Connect Transit is looking at adding Sunday service as well as late night and early service. Are those options standard in public transit systems across the U.S.?
It tends to be a matter of scale. Small cities tend to be a little more constrained in their operating hours, and then as they grow, they add night and weekend service. A lot of it also is driven by access to jobs. If people have second shift opportunities for work, providing that access through good public transportation nights and weekends gives them that ability to work more hours.
The ride-sharing service Uber has established a presence in Bloomington Normal. How does this transportation service fit into the transit landscape?
That's a great question. We're seeing transportation mobility options changing, and what we're seeing is young people and baby boomers are saying, I want choices besides just driving. So there's a place for all of it. It's all about the system working together. We can't keep looking at it just at transit, just as cars, or just as some other bikes or whatever it is. It's about all working together. If you can use a shared-use car, you can take Uber, you can have your own car, you can ride a bike, you can walk. Having those choices is really what makes a community very livable.
One of the busiest Amtrak corridors passes through Bloomington Normal, and we all heard about positive train control after the accident in Pennsylvania earlier this year that killed 8 people. Can you talk a little bit about positive train control?
We're very involved in the positive train control discussion. There is no question this is an important technology, and both the freight and passenger rail industries are 100% committed to implementing positive train control. This is a technology that's never been done before and certainly never done on this scale, where every train in the United States has to be able to talk to each other, every signal, every piece of equipment, every back office. And so getting that in place is critical. Now, the deadline for implementation that was set by Congress back in 2008 is the end of this year. It's December 31st. The reality is we're not going to be ready. The industry is not going to be ready. So we need an extension for positive train control. If we want to get fertilizer to the farmers, if we want to get passengers to be able to ride trains either in their commuter areas or on Amtrak, we need an extension for positive train control so we can get this technology in and get it right.
What is the APTA doing to push it along?
We're working with Congress to educate, and we represent all of the commuter rail operators in North America. So if you carry passengers on rail in North America, chances are good you're an APTA member.
Thank you very much for your time.
That was GLT's Michael Hill speaking with American Public Transportation Association President and CEO Michael Malanafy. Transportation funding is still under consideration as another highway trust fund deadline looms. Authorization to spend money from the fund will run out on October 29th if no action is taken. The House and Senate have yet to pass a bill to extend the program. Whether you're riding a bus or taking a car, location is key to getting around. Some restaurants don't last because they're in a poor location. Orange Leaf Yogurt on Main Street is one example, according to the Bloomington Normal restaurant scene. That shop faced the parking lot instead of the street. But in a discussion with GLT's Charlie Schlenker, Larry Carius, who authors the restaurant scene on Facebook, says another eatery is still doing well after a year in spite of being hard to find, and that's Crepe Geeks in Normal.
We revisited them a very short time ago, and Crepe Geek is doing pretty well. It's a hard restaurant to find, Charlie. If a person knows where the Domino's Pizza is across Buford Street from Watterson Towers, you look in the back half of that building, and there is Crepe Geek's. Ben, the owner, he actually was a crepier in Versailles and Paris, France for 5 years. Essentially, he came back to this area. Crepe Geeks is a carryout only restaurant. It was really fun talking with him to go back and see him, because he said a lot of Bloomington Normal people, when they stopped by, they didn't really know what an authentic French crepe was. He has the two 18-inch crepe makers right there in front where the counter is. And he said that the first time people come in, or even the second time, they just watch very intently as he makes the crepes. 65% of his sales now are probably to students. The remaining 35%, of course, would be for the townspeople. And he wants to increase his sales to townspeople. He said townspeople are coming in more and more and more. When the students were gone this summer, his business was still okay. So I think maybe Ben is going to be around for a while.
Speaking of being around a while, a longtime community institution, Shannon's Five Star recently got a national plug.
Absolutely. Paste Online magazine named Shannon's as one of the 40 college town diners across America that are worth visiting.
It's nowhere near the colleges.
I was surprised by this. Shannon was surprised also, but then as she was thinking about it, one of her very, very popular items out there is her breakfast buffet on Saturday and Sunday mornings. You know, it's all you can eat, somewhere around $8, and apparently the breakfast buffet on Saturday and Sunday morning is very popular with the students.
Catnip for college students.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
There's also a national look at burger places in Bloomington.
This is a fun type survey that Tabalog, it's a national survey company, and they do these type of surveys across the U.S., and they did a survey for the best burger joint in Bloomington. Now, this does not include Normal. It's just Bloomington. And you notice I said burger. I didn't say hamburger. Well, the number one burger joint in Bloomington Normal, as far as Tablog is concerned, is the Salmon Burger at Healthy in a Hurry.
Purists of the world are arising in arms even as we speak.
Absolutely. But she has many supporters for that. And my wife, Kay, totally agreed that the best burger in Bloomington Normal is the Salmon Burger at Healthy in a Hurry.
From a food truck.
From a food truck.
How are the others on the list?
Well, they were all the usual suspects that came in. The the Rosies, the Cheeks, the Big Daddies, Baxters, Schooners, 2Ks, Meatheads.
You reassure me. Civilization has not ended. Larry Carius writes about the Bloomington Normal foodscape on Facebook in the Bloomington Normal restaurant scene. Thanks so much for joining us, Larry.
Thank you, Charlie.
I'm Charlie Schlink.
Larry Carius also reports that Doc McKay's Bar and Grill off Hershey in Bloomington is also going strong, more than 10 months into its run. And Stefan Block of Two Blokes and a Bus has another double-decker bus he's putting into service. He's calling it the Busterant. It'll go into service around the end of this month. More than 10,000 people follow the Bloomington Normal restaurant scene on Facebook.
I'm Jeff Mavros, and my financial contribution helps make Sound Ideas possible. What do you think of Sound Ideas? The GLT News team wants to know. You can email comments to news@wglt.org.
Every day, you invite GLT into your home through your radio or smartphone. During this fund drive campaign, GLT is inviting you to help build a home. Every contribution to GLT will provide 2x4s to Habitat for Humanity thanks to Heinz Supply. It's our Listen, Pledge, Build partnership.
I'm Dylan Huntley. Thanks for your contribution to GLT. You're providing lumber for 3 new Habitat homes like mine.
Learn more about our Listen, Pledge, Build partnership and make your contribution at WGLT.org.
Support for GLT comes from Kurtz Auto Body Repair Shop Incorporated, 2025 Ireland Grove Road, offering professional estimates, accident repair, and automobile painting for over 44 years. On the web at KurtzAutoBody.com. This is GLT.
And at Sound Ideas, I'm Willis Kern. When the trees in a neighboring yard are ailing, it's natural to assume your own trees may be in danger. This week on GLT's Grow, Patrick Murphy helps out listeners with questions about sickly trees, including a gardener who's concerned about the future of his trees.
When a tree is ailing, it's a good idea to talk to an arborist. And I happen to know a good one. I'm Laura Kennedy, and this is GLT's Grow, your source for practical gardening advice from our expert in the field, Mr. Arborist, from the Illinois State University School of Biological Sciences. It is Patrick Murphy. Hello there, Murph.
Hello, Arborist Ho.
Ahoy there.
Yay.
Today on GLT's Grow, we have two questions dealing with trees submitted at WGLT.org/grow. The first is coming from Kevin in Normal, and he says, once it became hot, which is actually a little while ago, our neighbors lost 3 trees. He says 2 are deciduous, 1 is a conifer. He says he's not doing anything about it, his neighbor, and he's afraid his trees are going to get sick. He says, who should I call to come take a look at these, and what can I do?
Okay, well, I think that there's a lot of stuff in here we can address for you, Kevin. First and most importantly, to help alleviate any stress you might have, tree diseases are usually specific to a particular tree. Maple to maple, ash to ash.
Dust to dust.
Dust to dust. Oh, thank you, Lord. That's great. So it's not going to go from the evergreen to the deciduous tree. That would be very unusual and very rare. I want to help you, Kevin, so give me a little more information. Were these trees close to the house or out in the yard? Were they newly planted or were they existing and they remained after they constructed the homes? He's near the Constitution Trail area of the local community that we're sitting in now, Laura.
Normal.
And that's a newer subdivision, but the trees in that neighborhood are already over 20 feet tall, you know, so it's been there for a little while. Sometimes there can be issues related to new construction, and it has a negative impact on trees. But the important thing to know is there's really no defense you can put up to defend yourself from your neighbor's errors or your neighbor's best of intentions.
Yeah, you can't put a bubble over your house.
Right, and because the diseases aren't going to go from different trees typically, I think that you're okay.
But if he is worried and maybe he does have the same trees, maybe he should consult an arborist?
I think that's a great idea. You can look up local arborists that are for hire through the ISA website. That's the International Society of Arboriculture. That's the main organization that licenses and maintains the credentials for people that are arborists. And they're all different kinds. There's ornamental and horticulture landscape type arborists. Oh. And then there's utility arborists that are specialists for working around electrical lines. There are municipal arborists, people that specialize in maintaining large populations of trees for villages and towns and cities and things like that. And there's some that are all. You can be a master arborist and have all of those credentials.
I am a master arborist.
Hey, thank you so much, Kevin. We loved your question. And again, you can send us more information about your trees if you want further information. Now, you're listening to GLT's Grow, our weekly gardening show for those who like to get their hands dirty. And this week, we're talking about a couple of great questions that are sent to us about trees. The other one comes from Dave from Overland Park, Kansas. He says he's got what appears to be an ailing ginkgo in his front yard. It was planted last fall, looked great, and then this summer it started to look icky. The leaves started to turn yellow, the crown started to lose sections of leaves little by little, and it's just not looking all that good. And he thinks this is transplant shock. And the field was field-grown stock, and it was a big tree as well, 15 to 20 feet tall. So he wants to know if this is stress or maybe disease, and if he believes a large-sized transplant can recover there in the Kansas City area, where he says ginkgos tend to grow pretty well.
That's right. They're a reliable tree in that area. And I can tell you that this area that we're talking about, this Overland Park area and the residential area in particular, this is remote. These are extreme conditions. Flatline winds, probably during any season of the year, can be extreme. But I was just trying to do some detective work in between the sentences and kind of come up with my own theory.
Did you get security on that from Grow Corporate?
Grow Corporate sent a couple of armed guards out to Overland Park, Kansas, and we did a flyby at about 300 feet, and I've seen everything that could be seen there.
Right.
No, I just made that part up. That would be so cool if they would give us that chopper just for one day.
Or at least a drone.
I know. That'd be kind of cool. But this area has the very nice landscape that appears to be irrigated because everything around it is literally the Great Prairie. I don't know if it's the Great Kanza Prairie, but it's definitely the prairie with all of the contours and the rolling basins, if you will, and lots of different kinds of prairie vegetation and very few trees. So that's one thing I was able to deduct from the information that Davis shared with us. He also indicated that the tree was planted in the fall. Typically, ginkgo trees and a lot of other trees that are sold as shade trees, bald and burlapped, are harvested in the spring. They're cut from the ground and their roots in the spring. So if you buy a tree in the fall that was harvested in the spring, it could have been sitting out in a landscape yard or a nursery or a retail yard for a long time. And that could be one issue that developed that would be a chink in the armor, right? A little weakness because the tree started out under stress because it was cut from its own roots. Now, in contrast that to a container-grown tree, they are not cut from their own roots. They're in the pot that you buy the tree in.
So if he had gotten a smaller one from a pot, maybe
establishment could be quicker,
yeah,
and growth goes faster because it's kind of the opposite with the ball and burlap stuff. It's sleep, creep, and leap. So you put that thing in the ground and nothing happens. And then the next season, a little below ground root growth happens, and then the third season you start to get some new leaves and stuff. Container grown trees, they get established much quicker typically. But then I looked at the picture that Dave sent,
which is on our Grow webpage.
Yeah. And it's a really helpful photo because I would like to apply some tribal knowledge here and say it depends, but you know something I noticed? The way the branches are devoid of leaves in the photograph reminds me of some mistakes that I've witnessed in my own professional career that I was at fault for and I both witnessed. If you travel with a leafy tree any distance, even going a slow speed, you're putting a lot of stress and you're beating the leaves up if the tree is uncovered when it's transported. How would you cover a tree when it's transported? Well, they can wrap them like a cigar and have it sticking out the back of your trailer or your pickup truck, and you know, it's like driving home from deer hunting with that deer on your bumper. Everybody's, hey, man, I got me a tree. Well, whatever. It's a good way to protect the tree and its leaves. And there's products called Wiltproof and Antidescant that you can spray on your leafy shrubs and even your annuals, your trees, to protect them while they're being transported. I think that there was perhaps some hot weather when this tree was transported. It was already perhaps weak when it was purchased in the fall after being dug in the spring.
Mm-hmm.
even if it was dug that fall and planted that fall, you're still dealing with a large tree that has been separated from its roots.
Which has got to hurt.
And the ends of the roots are where the water and nutrients are taken up. The thick, fat roots closer to the trunk of the tree, their main function is to hold the tree to the ground and hold it upright. Takes those trees longer to establish. So if you get some dry weather, some intense winds, some late heat, you're looking for trouble. And I think Dave has an idea of that already, but I think maybe the drive damaged the tree a little bit.
Okay, so, and if he wants to try again, he might want to consider getting one in a pot rather than one that's bald and burlapped.
The sooner they get growing, the sooner they're growing. That's right.
Okay, well, that's great. Thank you so much, Murph. And thank you so much to Dave and to Kevin for their questions this week. Next week, we have actually another question from Kansas City. Neil is hoping for advice on selecting a hearty conifer. If you've got a gardening question or problem that you'd like Murph to tackle, go to our website, wglt.org/grow, fill in the form and send it along to us, and maybe Murph will pick your question to answer on the air. Submit those questions at wglt.org/grow.
And remember, you can download the Grow podcast every week at iTunes or wglt.org. I'm Willis Kern at Sound Ideas. 2015 is the 100th anniversary of the birth of blues legend Muddy Waters. In the late 70s through 1982, John Primer was a guitarist in the last incarnation of the Muddy Waters band. On this Talkin' Blues excerpt, Primer talks with GLT's John Norton about Waters, as well as the Rolling Stones. Primer also talks about the new tribute album, Muddy Waters 100, which features a number of guest artists, and Primer on vocals and guitar on most of the tunes.
Got My Mojo Working is the name of the song. The album is called Muddy Waters 100. And John Primer from the album joins us here on GLT's Talkin' Blues. First of all, it's nice to talk to you again, John. And a wonderful album. And the first thing I noticed the very first time I listened to the album was the opening track, which is a classic Muddy Waters song. But it's got some beats on this song that I wasn't expecting in a tribute album, especially coming from you. It's a wonderful release.
Man, he surprised me too. I didn't know it was going to come out like that either. I didn't do it that way in the studio, so they changed it around. I did the original stuff, but it did the studio. Yeah, they did all of that, and I wouldn't even involve with it.
Okay, so that wasn't your vision behind the album.
That's me. I'm playing on everything, singing and everything, but mixing and all that stuff, I didn't have nothing to do with it.
So
I got through my part in the studio, yeah.
Was that your producer, Larry Scholar, who was behind that then?
Yeah. He did all that. I mean, it's good. They did a good job. I didn't have no idea it was going to be like, you know, coming out that way.
Do you consider this a John Primer album?
I consider it a Muddy Waters, but it's all about Muddy. I'm singing, but my name is up there like the rest of them that are playing on there in that category. That's the Muddy Waters 100 years tribute.
Well, they call it a tribute from John Primer with special guests, so that's why it looks like your name is front and center on this.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. What did you think of the sound when it came out then?
I think it was great, man.
Because it walks a fine line between, reverence for Muddy Waters and some different sounds that doesn't make it stuck in the 1950s.
Right, yeah. But see, yeah, it's nice the way they did it, yeah. I'm the kind of guy that when I do mine, they're going to be like, there's going to be original stuff, keeping it alive. But original music was, but it's going to be the same blues. I'm not going to change the blues format. My stuff, that's their stuff, you know. All I do is work, get some gigs from it, but it's based on the 100 years of Muddy Waters, though. Because everybody asking me why I didn't play a lot of guitar on there. Why I didn't play much lead. That's the only problem was with it. I'm not playing enough lead on it. Everybody tells me that. So it sounds great, though. It's a good thing. I hope it win a Grammy. Yeah, it's a nice CD. I love it, you know. I like the way they changed it. Yeah.
Well, that's
I'm just surprising with it. That's all what I do with it.
Well, that's two train running. Well, there and now one day.
Let's talk about Muddy himself then. You worked with him for, what, the last 4 years of his life?
Yeah, almost 4 years.
Yeah, and it sounds like the two of you became fairly close, at least professionally, if not personally.
Yeah, just professional work, man. He was great guy to work for, yeah. It's all about business, yeah. All work and no play.
That's how Muddy was as a band leader?
Yeah, he worked business, yeah. Great guy. Play whatever you want when you come to the bandstand. When he comes to the bandstand, play his That's exactly what he said.
Well, I would imagine you learn a lot about band leading by playing in a band with someone like that, yeah.
Yeah, I learned a lot. Do things, you know, I already knew, but I'd learned more from him, yeah. Playing with all the great guys, you know, at Teresa Lounge and stuff, Junior Wells and all them people, you know, I love it. But Muddy, he put the icing on the cake for me.
I am ready for you. I hope you ready for me.
You played with, a number of bigger names over the years, but with Muddy himself, what did you take away from him while you were playing with him?
Actually, I didn't take anything, but you can't take that from Muddy Waters. He was the main. You know, all I did was just learn from him. I learned how to play more slide. Could play slide, but I learned more how to play it the way he played it, right? The way he played slide. And my voice is just natural the way I sing. I don't try to sing like Muddy. I just sing and learn his stuff and sing it. You can tell it's me singing on there. To me, on that CD, I sound like me.
Johnny Winter played on I'm Ready, and Johnny was credited with jump-starting Muddy's career back in the late mid to late 1970s. Did you and Johnny Winter ever work together with Muddy?
No, not at the band. Two shows in New York at the Beacon Theater and different places, and Chicago Blues Fest. He came special guests a few times. So Muddy got his band together, you know. He came out. A special guest on the show, worked with him, yeah. Got a video at the Chicago Blues Fest where he came up and gave me a solo and fanned me with the hat, with his hat, my hand with his hat.
Did you ever see the effect that Johnny had on Muddy, or did Muddy ever talk about the effect?
Oh, yeah. But he never said that. He's a bad man. That's all Muddy would say, he's a bad man. Yeah, Johnny, they were real good buddies, yeah. So, Johnny, you the boss.
John Primer is the voice you're hearing. We're talking about the new tribute album to Muddy Waters. It's called Muddy Waters 100. John is the lead name on the album. A lot of special guests, including the late Johnny Winter, but Shamika Copeland, James Cotton, Bob Margolin. And I want to ask you about that right now, and that you're part of a real special fraternity of those who did play with Muddy Waters, and, you know, including Johnny and James and Bob Margolin. James played with Muddy for a good 10 years in the band together. What's your relationship with James Cotton been?
Oh, we're good friends. Good buddies, yeah. I worked in James' band back in the days, yeah. Sometimes, you know, go on the road with him. I used to go on the road with James Cotton, yeah. When Muddy got sick and I started playing Magic Slim, and then after that, I played with Cotton sometime, you know. And the house band at Teresa, he'd come off the road and he'd come down there and work. He always come to Teresa, yeah. He never used his band down there every once in a while, but played house band, yeah. Cotton was a great guy. He's a good guy.
You know that film is out there of when the Rolling Stones showed up at the Checkerboard in 1981, I think it was, right before Muddy passed away?
Right, yeah.
Is that you on stage?
Yeah.
Okay, that's what I thought.
So. All night. I didn't even take a break.
Oh, really?
No, Muddy wouldn't let me. He told me to stay up there and keep the band together. Those guys surprised me. They came by that night. It was a good video.
Oh, you didn't know they were coming that night?
It was a rumor. It was a rumor that they supposed to. That was the deal. They supposed to show up. I mean, Muddy Waters probably know they was coming, but, you know, I'm looking. Who would be that Rolling Stone? I never met them. I said, no, they ain't coming down here. There's another guy there. We always come to town to see him when he playing the Checkerboard Lounge. You'd be by the guys old club. Mm-hmm. And the name was Lefty Diz. And they'd always come to town. They would come to see the Diz, Lefty Diz.
Yeah, it got awful crowded up on that stage after a while.
Oh, man. Everybody was drunk. Oh, if I was drunk, you look at them.
So you were keeping the band together that night on the stage. That's a great story, yeah.
Yeah, you keep Rizzo off me a cigarette. I don't even smoke. I took the cigarette like I smoked.
While it's getting late on me, I feel like
like going back home. When I woke up this morning, all I had was gone. Getting late on the evening, I feel like blowing my horn. Well now, woke up this morning, all I had was gone. Well, brook running ocean, ocean one, and to the sea. If I don't find my baby, somebody sure gone. Baby, meanwhile, brook running ocean, and ocean run into the sea. Somebody sure gonna bury me.
That's John Primer from Muddy Waters 100, the new Waters tribute album, with guests including James Cotton, Johnny Winter, Shamika Copeland, Derek Trucks, and Billy Branch. You can hear more of John Norton's interview with Primer coming up Saturday night at 7 here on GLT. That's Sound Ideas for today, with help from Michael Hill, Charlie Schlenker, Laura Kennedy, and John Norton. And thanks to ISU President Larry Dietz for visiting the show again. Sound Ideas is edited by Taylor Bauer. I'm Willis Kern. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal.